Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Naomi Klein is an award-winning journalist and the author of the international bestseller, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, as well as the author of the book No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies. Her new book is This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and a pleasure to welcome Naomi Klein to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to this subject and looking at capitalism versus the climate?
Well, what brought me to the subject was really my last book, The Shock Doctrine, which was about how disasters of various kinds, shocks of various kinds, were increasingly being harnessed to push through a very radical pro-corporate agenda. And that book started off focusing on the Iraq War, then looked at how economic crises were used towards those ends. But as I was researching the book, I started to see these tactics used in the wake of climate-related disasters like Hurricane Katrina. So that book really ends with this vision of, you know, if we stay on the road we're on, it's not just that the temperature is going to go up. It's that the world's going to become a lot more brutal and privatized and less equal. And so this book is really charting an alternate course. It's arguing that we can respond to climate change by healing our broken economic system, building a better economy in lots of ways, a fair economy.
I ask the question because you start off talking about this in the book, and I think it's an important thing to address and then move on, and that is about those who deny that climate change exists. This is a movement, and it's I'm curious as to how powerful you think it has been and how much of an impediment it is in having us move forward.
Yeah, so the first chapter of the book is about the sort of hard right-wing climate change denier movement. I went to one of the annual gatherings of the Heartland Institute, which is sort of ground zero of the climate denier movement. And, you know, you ask how powerful they are. Well, that year, their scheduled keynote speaker was James Inhofe, and after the elections a few days ago, it looks like he's going to, you know, have the senior most position on environmental issues, and he is a card-carrying climate change denier, you know, incredibly vocal, wrote a book about it, calling it a grand hoax. So this is a movement that exerts real power. It doesn't represent the mainstream opinion. It doesn't represent the views of the majority of Americans. But in terms of political power, they punch above their weight, for sure, and have spread a huge amount of uncertainty. I think there's also been, that movement has been incredibly effective at just jamming comment sections and going after anybody who talks about climate change in a way that has intimidated a lot of people and made them not even want to weigh into this debate for a while. I think that is changing, frankly. You know, as I was researching the book, I saw a real shift where I was really feeling that they were becoming less influential and more people because they were witnessing the extreme weather events in their lives, you know, whether it's Hurricane Sandy or the California drought. It was just sort of like reality was interfering and it was defeating their arguments. That said, you know, within the U.S. electoral system, this is a movement that's gaining, not losing power.
So meanwhile, there is the science, number one. There is also recent reports from the United Nations saying that this is a international health crisis. There is the Pentagon saying that this is a national security issue. So there now are all of these facets and all of these fronts that have shown great concern over the issue, an issue that has been raising concerns for decades. So what is it about, again, going back to capitalism, this versus capitalism, when all of these various facets are coming forward and saying, look, this is a real problem that we need to address?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the argument I make in the book is that the reason we have failed to rise to this challenge is not because the science isn't in and not because we don't know what to do. You know, the science is in. We do know the kinds of policies that work. We, you know, there are countries that have adopted them, and, you know, Denmark has 40% of their power coming from renewable energy, and they have since the 1980s. You know, so it's possible to do this. Germany has 25% of their electricity coming from renewable energy. The argument I make is that if we want to understand the failure, we have to look at the incredibly bad case of historical timing this crisis has had. It hit us. It hit the sort of collective consciousness at the worst possible moment in our collective evolution, and that moment was the late 1980s. And that's when we lost all plausible deniability, when James Hansen testified on Capitol Hill that he now had a high degree of certainty that there was a connection between emissions and warming. That was the moment when this wave of what was called globalization was sweeping the world. It was the year after the Berlin Wall fell, and it was the triumphant moment for this, what Joseph Stiglitz has called market fundamentalism. And that's why the subtitle of the book is Capitalism versus the Climate, because it is this extreme form of sort of so-called pro-market ideology that has put us in conflict with the things we need to do to respond to this crisis. Because, of course, we do need to regulate corporations. We do need to raise corporate taxes and make polluters pay. We do need to act collectively, both, you know, at the national level and the international level. And all of these things became sort of ideologically heretical in this very period. So that's why so many environmental groups tended to focus on what you can do as an individual consumer, change your light bulbs, drive a hybrid, or setting up so-called market-based solutions, like setting up, you know, emissions trading, so put, you know, creating markets for pollution, really ineffective tools in the face of a crisis of this scale and complexity. But this was done because it was seen as not challenging that ideological project.
You also talk about privatization, of how while we have moved to reduce government and that movement to reduce government through privatization, that ultimately that has cost us more because we've often started that process and then had to back out of it.
I mean, if we think about what are the tools that we need to respond to this crisis, you know, we need to be able to make bold laws, and this has become more difficult. But in this same period, one of the things that happened is that our governments sold off many of the key sectors of our economy that are most central to our use of energy, whether it's national rail systems, whether it's national energy companies, utilities. They were all being auctioned off in the late 80s and 1990s. This made it harder to respond swiftly, because when all of these parts of the economy are controlled by private players who are only interested in short-term profits, it is a lot harder to respond. So one of the, you know, I mentioned Germany and how Germany has 25% of their electricity coming from renewable energy, much of it wind and solar. Now, this has happened because Germany introduced a well-designed national feed-in tariff program. But it's also happened because in hundreds of cities and towns, German citizens have voted to take back control over their electricity grids from the private players who privatized them in the 1990s, because they felt that they needed that control in order to transition quickly.
You make the point in the book, and it's such a great point, and you ask this question, which is, how do we stop fossil fuel profits from continuing to hemorrhage into executive paychecks and shareholder pockets? So let me turn that question and ask you that question, because what you say is so important, that ultimately what is being rejected is our culture of lopsided sacrifice, as you write, in which individuals are asked to pay higher prices for supposedly green choices, while large corporations dodge regulations and not only refuse to change their behavior, but charge ahead with even more polluting activities. What do we do about that?
Yeah, so as part of this sort of ideological lock-in that I've been describing, it was sort of taken for granted that if you were going to introduce green policies, you would just pass on the price to consumers, that you would have to pay extra for renewable energy, that you would, in the same way that you pay extra for that, you know, green laundry detergent at the supermarket. And that's, there, you know, that fed this perception of environmental action being this sort of luxury, something that, you know, rich people care about, but not anyone else. I think it's this model that has really failed, and particularly in the wake of the economic crisis and the financial collapse in 2008, that's when you started to see the whole sort of green consumer bubble burst because people stopped being willing to pay those premium prices because they were in economic pain and they couldn't afford it anymore. At the same time, they were seeing that the fossil fuel companies were in the midst of a frenzy of new projects, whether it was tar sands pipelines or natural gas fracking. So, you know, while consumers were being asked to pay more, companies were clearly enabled to do whatever they wanted. So in terms of, you know, what the model needs to be, I think probably the best model is the tobacco companies, who eventually were forced to help foot the bill for programs educating the public about quitting smoking, helped pay the health care costs associated with smoking, because it was understood that the product that they had been selling was dangerous. They knew it was dangerous. They suppressed research. They spread misinformation, much like the fossil fuel companies themselves. And, you know, frankly, I think the industry really lives in fear of the tobacco industry precedent. It gets openly discussed. And I think that that's the model that we need to see. It's interesting, you know, since the book was published, there was a bit of a breakthrough that happened right before the big climate summit in New York when the Rockefeller Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation and the individuals in the Rockefeller family announced that they were going to divest from fossil fuels and they were going to move their money into renewable energy. And, you know, it's interesting, obviously, the name Rockefeller is, you know, synonymous with oil. This is the family that founded Standard Oil, eventually turned into Mobil, eventually ExxonMobil, the most profitable company on Earth. And, you know, when they made this announcement, they said, we believe we have a special responsibility precisely because our family's money comes from oil to help fund the transition. So essentially what they're articulating is a polluter pays principle. The problem is it's on a voluntary basis, and it needs to actually be imposed, and it can't just be about individuals and foundations. It has to be really about the companies themselves, about ExxonMobil, which is still the most profitable company in the world that made $45 billion in profits. So there's a, you know, there is a range of ways that this can happen: higher royalty rates, higher taxes on exports. You could create a climate risk bonds, which would mean that whenever a company extracts fossil fuels, they would have to put money into a fund that would help us pay for the transition away from fossil fuels.
I know I have talked about this extensively with Bill McKibben, mm-hmm. who has talked about this. And you write in the book, when it comes to divesting from fossil fuels, no tactic in the climate wars has resonated more powerfully. Within 6 months of the campaign's official launch in November 2012, there were active divestment campaigns in over 300 campuses in more than 100 U.S. cities, states, and religious institutions. So as you say, the question is that it's voluntary. How do you make it mandatory?
Yeah. But I see this as very connected because, you know, that the fossil fuel divestment movement was really kickstarted by that amazing piece that Bill McKibben wrote in Rolling Stone magazine, which was headlined "Do the Math," right?
And
this piece was based on this research that came out of the UK, the Carbon Tracker Institute, that broke down for the first time the fact that the fossil fuel companies have five times more carbon in their proven reserves than our atmosphere can absorb and still leave us a 50-50 chance of keeping temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius warming. And that's the target that our own governments have agreed to, including the U.S. government, when they went to Copenhagen in 2009. So that's a business model that has essentially declared war on life on Earth. And if it is allowed to continue, then we don't, right? And so it was just having those numbers, having that research that just galvanized people to say to their universities, to say to their faith institutions, their city councils, it is unethical to profit from this model. And the whole fossil fuel divestment movement has been a process of delegitimizing those profits. Now, I see that as a first step towards actually laying claim to those profits. Because if those profits are illegitimate, then the public has a right to get a much larger piece of them in the same way that we did with the tobacco company's profits to pay the enormous costs of transitioning away from fossil fuels and preparing for the heavy weather that is already locked in because we've waited so long.
Naomi Klein is the author of This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation with Naomi Klein about This Changes Everything and about climate change after this break. We welcome back Naomi Klein, who is our guest. We're talking about her new book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Before we went to a break, we were talking about divesting from fossil fuels and the importance of that movement. One of the other things and the bright spots that you talk about in the book, it's a very powerful chapter in the book, is about indigenous rights and about indigenous peoples having legitimate legal claims to much of the land that we are eyeing for fossil fuel extraction. Give us a sense of how much land we're talking about and how big an impact this could have.
First of all, it really is already having a very big impact, and it's one that I think has been woefully undercovered by the mainstream press, if I may say. I'm Canadian, and in Canada, this is really an issue that's sort of front-page news because First Nations, as Indigenous people in Canada are called, our courts, our Supreme Court, has affirmed again and again the legitimacy, the legal power of Aboriginal land title. So to give you an example of how much land we're talking about, well, British Columbia, which is an incredibly resource-rich part of Canada, is 80% unceded territory, which means that this is land that has never been given away under any treaty or under war. It is still Indigenous land. And what the courts have affirmed is that that means that nothing can happen on that land without the consent of the people who live there. So what this has meant in concrete terms is, as you know, there's a huge amount of resistance to build the Keystone XL pipeline through the United States, and that's carrying tar sands oil from Canada, from Alberta, through the United States. And that the resistance has come from a coalition of farmers, ranchers, also Indigenous people in the United States who are using their land rights to say, this impacts us, this violates our treaty rights. And as that pipeline has encountered resistance, there's been a big push to move the oil to the west through British Columbia. And Indigenous people in British Columbia have been very clear that they simply won't let it through their territory. And this is starting to spread investor worries. That investors are losing confidence about building new mines in the Alberta tar sands precisely because they're not sure they can get the oil out. Statoil is it's a huge oil company owned by the Norwegian government, and they announced just last month, once again since my book came out, that they were putting a huge planned tar sands expansion project on hold indefinitely because of, and this is a quote, pipeline uncertainty. This is a very concrete example of how Indigenous rights, forcefully defended by social movements and Indigenous people themselves, are already keeping carbon in the ground. In the United States, I talk a lot in the book about a big fight going on in Montana, led by the Northern Cheyenne, who are sitting on one of the largest unmined coal deposits in North America. And that's just one example, of what we're talking about here. I mean, the stakes are enormously high. And the Northern Cheyenne have been resisting allowing that coal to be mined for a very long time. And they're really at the forefront of this movement and are in the process of helping to successfully block a railway that would carry the coal out of the Powder River Basin and over to the Pacific Northwest, where it would be exported through coal export terminals that are also being resisted by other Indigenous people like the Lummi in Washington State, who say that building coal export terminals violate their treaty rights and their right to fish because it could harm their fishing, their traditional fishing territories. So, this is, like I said, it's really something that doesn't get covered enough. But the power is real and the impact's already happening.
Let's talk about fracking. And I'd like to begin by talking about what's happening in New York State, because we have seen the movement come and say, okay, we should do this in New York State. Strong opposition to that. a governor who has been fairly successful of kicking the can down the road and saying, I'll make a decision, has been able to make a to push it off after the election, wins re-election, and now many are eyeing and saying, okay, isn't it about time that, a decision is made? My question is twofold. One, what pressure do you think politicians, and let's use Governor Andrew Cuomo as an example of what pressure you're under, and then especially when it's supported by the President of the United States, and then say, okay, what are the possibilities? And at some point you have to make a decision and decide which way you're going to go, and how long standing can that decision be?
Well, look, I think if it were up to him, he would have already approved it. And it's a victory of the anti-fracking movement that it hasn't, you know, that the moratorium has held for as long as it has. And I think there were a lot of losses in the midterm election. But, you know, interestingly, one of the successes was the anti-fracking movement. There were several municipalities that passed bans on fracking, including Denton, Texas, which was where the practice began. It's a sort of ground zero of the fracking boom. There were a couple other constituencies as well. So, you know, I think whatever he decides, the resistance isn't going anywhere. I mean, the anti-fracking movement in New York State is one of the most powerful in the country. But, you know, it's interesting, just in the past, you know, I would say 6 months or so, more and more people who have been focused on saying no to fracking are sort of dividing their time between sort of holding that line and also advancing a positive pathway towards renewable energy as an alternative to fracking. So, for instance, Joss Fox, who made Gasland, Sandra Steingraber, who's really been at the forefront, the biologist of the anti-fracking movement in New York State. If you go to solutions.org, the website solutions.org, you'll see this pathway that is being laid out based on research coming out of Stanford University by Mark Jacobson that makes the case that we can move to 100% renewable energy by 2030. And they break it down state by state, including New York State. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why fracking it has been pushed effectively by industry is this idea that renewables aren't ready for prime time, that we can't do it without fracked natural gas. And now we have such solid research saying that's simply not true. We can do it. We have the technology. The economics are there. What's lacking is the political will. And we can do it. We do need a bridge. You know, there is a period where we will still need to burn fossil fuels in order to lay out the infrastructure to get off fossil fuels. But critically, what Mark Jacobson at Stanford says is we can do it with conventional fossil fuels. We can do it with conventional gas. We can do it with conventional oil. We don't need to go after the extra high-risk stuff like tar sands and fracked natural gas.
The subtitle of the book is Capitalism versus the Climate. You spoke a moment ago as to why that is the subtitle. When it comes to capitalism, how much is the subtlety there? Really, we're talking about greed.
Well, I think the issue is that we have an economic system that is based on pursuing short-term greed, short-term economic growth at all costs, that discourages economic planning, that discourages us from planning the kind of economy that we actually want. But, you know, the reason why I use that subtitle is because there is a procrastination penalty to waiting, and that's a term that Michael Mann, the climate scientist at Penn State University, who wrote Hockey Stick and the Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, uses. There's a procrastination penalty for waiting as long as we have to respond to this crisis, right? I mean, we have been talking about, our governments have been talking about lowering emissions since 1990, and in that time, emissions have gone up by 61%. Or actually, that's the statistic I use in my book, but it's actually now it's gone up to 64%. And it's the nature of greenhouse gases that they stay in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. And you know, so it's not like, you know, they just dissipate and we start from zero every year. No, it gets worse the longer we delay. And so that means that now if we do want to ward off catastrophic warming, we need to cut our emissions so quickly that they really challenge the logic of building an economy based on pursuing short-term economic growth. It requires that we contract parts of our economy and expand the parts of our economy that are low carbon. And that is what presents such a profound challenge to the economic model that we have.
So when it comes to that challenge, where does your optimism lie?
Well, honestly, my optimism lies in the fact that this economic system that I'm describing is failing people on so many other fronts besides climate change. You know, I always say this when I'm, you know, talking about the book. It's not as if we're dealing with an economic system that is working perfectly, except for the small matter of rising sea levels. It's that we're dealing with an economic system that is failing the vast majority of people on so many other fronts besides climate change, and there is such a desire for change out there to address rampant inequality, and the way in which that pursuit of short-term greed is ravaging people's lives and their communities and their health in so many other areas. My hope is that the urgency of the climate crisis, the fact that it puts us on a science-based deadline and says, look, it's now or never, we really have to do this in the next decade, that this can be the catalyst to encourage so many different constituencies that are impacted by this same greed-based thinking to work together and really build a broad-based social movement, which is the only thing that has led to profound economic change in the past.
Because it is easy to be very pessimistic and cynical.
It certainly is, but I mean, it's especially after, you know, elections like we just saw, but that's a good example. You know, everybody knows the corrosive impact of so-called dark money on those elections. And, you know, much of it oil money, much of it gas money, much of it coal money. But everybody working on to get anything vaguely progressive done in the United States, whether it's, you know, gun control or, you know, healthcare reform, or dealing with private prisons, whatever it is, they know that the single greatest obstacle is the corrosive impact of money in politics. So, you know, this is the idea is that climate could be, you know, it could build a political, a big political tent, a movement of movements. And after all, the Earth's atmosphere is already a pretty big political tent. You know, we're already all under it. We just need to start acting like it.
The name of the book is This Change is Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate. Naomi Klein, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you so much.
A great pleasure.
Great talking with you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book is This Changes Everything by Naomi Klein. Capitalism versus the Climate is the subtitle. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.